to begin with a story which, even though I've abridged it somewhat, is still a little bit long. It's a story from one of Oliver Sacks' books. It begins by saying, Rebecca was 19 when she was referred to our clinic. But as her grandmother said, just like a child in some way, she couldn't find her way around the block. She couldn't confidently open a door with a key. She sometimes put on her clothes the wrong way, inside out, back to front, without appearing to notice. She seemed, as her grandmother said, to have no sense of space. She was clumsy and ill-coordinated. A klutz, one report said, a motor moron, another. Although when she danced, all her clumsiness disappeared. Rebecca had a partial cleft palate, which caused a whistling in her speech, degenerative myopia requiring very thick spectacles. She was painfully shy and withdrawn, feeling that she was and had always been a figure of fun. But she formed warm, deep, even passionate attachments. She deeply loved her grandmother, who had raised her. She loved nature and stories, although she never learned to read. She was at home with poetic language and was herself, in a stumbling, touching way, a sort of primitive, natural poet. She was devout, loved the lighting of the Shabbat candles, going to synagogue, and fully understood the liturgy, chants, rites, and symbols in the Orthodox service. All this was possible for her despite the fact that she couldn't count change and scored low in all IQ tests. Thus she was a moron, a fool, or had so appeared and been called her whole life, but one with an unexpected, strangely moving poetic power. Superficially, she was a mass of handicaps and incapacities, and at this level she felt herself to be a mental cripple. But on a deeper level, there was no sense of incapacity, but a feeling of calm and completeness, of being fully alive. Spiritually, she felt herself a full and complete being. When I first saw her in the clinic, I saw her merely as a casualty, a broken creature who scored low on all tests. The next time was very different. I came across her in the garden, sitting on a bench, delighting in the beautiful spring day. She sat composed, with her face calm and smiling. She could have been any young woman basking in the warmth of the sun. This was my human, as opposed to my neurological vision. Spurts of poetic, sudden words fell from her lips as she described the beauty of the day. She had scored appallingly in all the tests, yet they had given no inkling of anything but the deficits. They had given me no hint of her positive powers, no intimation of her inner world that was composed, coherent, and poetic. I realized the inadequacy of our evaluations. They failed to show us the beauty of Rebecca, who enjoyed not only a simple but sacred view of nature, who was filled with promise and potential. What I saw in Rebecca, what she showed me, I began to see in all the patients in the clinic. Rebecca was the first to tell me that we paid far too much attention to the defects of our patients and far too little to what was intact or preserved. When I read this story, I had a sense of how Rebecca's story could, in many ways, be any of our stories. It can seem rare for us to feel that we are seen fully, heard fully, or understood. The story of Rebecca's psychiatrist could probably equally be our story. We see how we can go through our lives rarely seeing, understanding, or appreciating another person fully. That there are so many moments that we miss. or how rare it is that we feel we truly see the whole of this moment, of another person or of ourselves. Perhaps we recognize in ourselves our tendency to seize upon the details, to seize upon the fragments and the particulars of this life, and assume them to be the truth. The spiritual path holds at its heart a deep willingness to probe beneath the surface of all things, to endeavor to deeply understand what is true and what is whole. A meditative path holds at its heart a willingness to question everything, to dive beneath the world of appearances, to investigate all of our constructs, our assumptions, our conclusions, our images, our opinions, all of that world that we can hold on to so tightly, and instead to dedicate ourselves to deeply understanding the simple truths of each moment. Because this is where we find harmony, and it is also where we find freedom. My sense is that it takes great courage and also truly a great generosity of heart to find the willingness to cross the borders in our own hearts and minds, to cross the borders created very often by our assumptions and judgments and conclusions. At times, crossing the borders of our own hearts and minds means surrendering the apparent but also illusory safety, sense of safety in our lives that seems to rely upon knowing, upon images, upon opinions. Investigation is said to be the most important factor, the most significant factor of enlightenment. Investigation is said to be the quality that leads to depth and awakening. It's the factor that transforms us, that takes us from the territory of what we know to what we don't know. Investigation, too, is said to be a major piece of the path of peace, of ending conflict. And in every moment in our lives, perhaps we sense that investigation truly means taking nothing for granted, that it's rooted in a genuine openness of heart and spaciousness of mind. Sometimes investigation is called a quality of divine curiosity. If we step back and look at how we see the world, perhaps we sense that the world really is what we believe it to be, that our world of the moment is what we believe it to be, that we become who we believe ourselves to be, that other people are very often seen through the veil of who we believe them to be. Some of our beliefs are formed just in the space of a moment. If you track the journey of your mind, the journey of your heart through the day, you see this changing tide of beliefs. I'm sad, I'm worthless, I'm wonderful, I'm inadequate. The changing faces of our inner identities, our inner judgments, inner assumptions, that we go through countless times in a day. Some of our beliefs are much more historical. They're deeply rooted in past experience and very often our most solid, our most impenetrable personal beliefs are rooted in painful past experience. That kind of underlying core of belief that we keep telling ourselves about, I'm helpless or incomplete or vulnerable. we can see that in our day, in our life, our outer experience plays a part, it plays a role in shaping our beliefs. If on your way here this evening someone spoke to you harshly, or you came in the door and smiled at someone who ignored you, or someone said something offensive to you, how easy it is in that moment to take hold of that and to believe, oh, either you're deeply insensitive or I am truly hopeless and unlovable. We see in our lives if there's a moment when we fail to reach some desired experience or goal, how that experience can shape our inner core of belief. Somehow I'm a failure or not quite good enough. If someone praises us and applauds us, shows us kindness, we can see our hearts lift and our whole sense of identity take a different shape as we believe ourselves in that moment to be lovable and worthy. And of course, our supporter is the most fantastic person in the world. Meditation, our experiences in meditation can shape our beliefs moment to moment, doesn't it? You sit in a sitting that's really grim and miserable and fragmented, and it's not so often in those moments you sense, oh, I'm just a terrific meditator. You know, but you sit in the moments, you know, that are really, you know, blissful. And, oh, yes, you know, near to enlightenment, this Buddha, you know. We can see ourselves shaping it. We also see the way that our inner experience shapes our outer world or our belief in what the outer world is. If we feel it in ourselves lonely or sad or depressed or somehow contracted, we move through our day, you know, with this sense of the world is so bleak, everybody in it is so grim, so self-centered, so depressed. When we feel calm and peaceful, we're so delighted that the whole world is sharing in our serenity and openness. Amidst all the changes that we see ourselves going through in these inner identities and beliefs, it's really remarkable to see the way we can still get so hooked by the belief of the moment, the assumption of the moment. It's probably clear to us that our way of seeing ourselves, a way of seeing the world, is somewhat formed and shaped by our personal constructs. Our constructs is that whole package of opinions and views and judgments and assumptions. Sometimes they're just born of the dominant mind state of the moment, and sometimes they are much more deeply rooted. I do a lot of long airplane flights that I really just don't enjoy at all. So whenever I'm going on a flight, I kind of have to psych myself up, you know, about, oh yes, about this is how to do it, and, you know, just relax and be in the moment, you know, and go to sleep or whatever. But anyway, I was once about to get on a plane to go to Los Angeles from London. And I went to check in, you know, being as equanimous as possible. And I saw in the check-in line in front of me 13 Elvis Presley lookalikes. And I saw this, and I suddenly had this sinking feeling that this flight was going to be even more of a challenge than usual. And indeed it was, you know. I mean, they had all the hair and the clothes, and that was how, you know, it was their kind of construct. It was fine. It could be anything, couldn't it? I mean, But throughout the flight, of course, you know, periodically they would break into these Elvis Presley songs, you know, that would rocket through the plane. And the worst thing was nobody else could ever get in the bathrooms because there was so much hair to take care of. So that was kind of like one reality, you know, it was like one reality. And then I landed in L.A. and I was teaching a retreat in Beverly Hills, and it was quite an affluent part of Beverly Hills. And I got up in the morning and I, you know, went out for my morning walk, and I was the only one on the street. It was like I was the only person on the planet, you know. And I kept seeing all these signs, you know, like, if you pass this line, you will be shot. And I thought, here's another reality, you know, it was another reality. It could no better, no worse than any of ours, just another reality. And then I went from there to visit my parents who live in a retirement community in Arizona. You know, and I went out for my morning walk, and I was the slowest person there, you know, and everybody was zooming by me, telling me, you know, that I was, you know, that I needed to speed up, I needed to be more active. It's the journey. We see ourselves journeying all the time through these constructs. I mean, we see it in our own lives. Have you ever looked back through one of your family's photograph albums, you know, that features you? It's interesting, isn't it? You know, there you were as, you know, the young, shining scout or brownie, you know, and then there you were as the hippie, and, you know, then there you were as the, you know, the student or the shining success. And we see that similar journey, I think, much more subtly in meditation. You know, that the journey that we go through, sometimes feeling so conflicted and contracted and filled with doubt, and then we have that moment of opening and, you know, peace and clarity, and then back to cynicism and questioning, and then back to appreciation. We see it all the time, this kind of like changes in our consciousness that seems so true in the moment and so questionable in the next moment. There are also collective constructs where our individual beliefs and opinions and preferences and judgments find support and agreement with the beliefs of others, the allegiances, political, you know, racism is a construct, sexism is a construct. They are all collective constructs. I mean, some of our constructs, individually and collectively, can be quite neutral. But I think it's probably apparent to us that many of our constructs can be deeply damaging and harmful. That they may have little at times to do with understanding or compassion or generosity or what is true. That many of our constructs may have much to do with fear and anxiety. Nagarjuna, one of the great Indian mystics, once said, "To cling is to insist upon being someone, and not to cling is to be free to be no one." And curiously, when we cling and insist upon being someone, invariably that means that we also insist upon others also being someone. A journey of wisdom and a journey of freedom is a journey where we're seeking to bring our own personal realities, our personal constructs, closer and closer to what is actually true, to the simple truth of the moment. And for many of us, that journey is a journey of untangling, of undoing, of probing, of investigation, not only for our own well-being and freedom, but also for the healing and the well-being and the freedom of all things. It's apparent how much conflict and hatred and alienation is born of a clash of constructs, a collision between different constructs and beliefs of individuals, of groups, of nations. Sometimes then it would be a wonderful thing to invite the person who we disagree with the most to spend just a day together silently. A couple of years ago I was teaching in Israel, and it was the first time on a retreat in Israel that the retreat was made up not only of the Israeli Jewish population, but also of the Israeli Arab and Palestinian Arab people who came on the retreat. And initially, everybody talked really about how difficult it was, even in silence, just to see one another. Would at times set off waves that they talked about of mistrust or unease. A week together in silence was a remarkably transforming and healing experience that, quite frankly, could never have happened, or perhaps maybe much more difficult for that to happen through words. When we are willing sometimes to be silent and to listen, we can see that we begin to break down some of the constructs, or at least begin to question some of the constructs and some of the beliefs that can so imprison and divide us. Because when we're silent, somehow we are naturally more aware of what is happening within ourselves. We're returned to ourselves. And we begin to see how the moments of judgment, the moments of assumption or belief, are simultaneously often moments of withdrawal and contraction and division. And we see too, as they begin to soften, that there is often a beginning of healing, of an emerging into our own wholeness. If we look on a bigger picture, we see that the journey of freedom, whether it's been for women or for any group of people who have ever existed in the shadows of life, that their journey of freedom has always been one of breaking down constructs, of breaking down beliefs and images and judgments. This is also an individual journey. When we are silent, listening within ourselves, we see that whenever we are prone to say, "I am," or "you are," that those are the moments that we are missing the whole. We're missing the completeness of the moment. And in that process of seizing upon a fragment, a detail, a particular description, despair and judgment is born of not seeing the whole. We also learn that we can release that holding, that contractedness. We cultivate in meditation a culture of creative disbelief. A culture of creative disbelief, of questioning all of our opinions and judgments, all of the moments when we find ourselves prone to seize upon a fragment and assume it to be the truth. When I was teaching that retreat in Israel, I had this really interesting experience that I came out of the office one day and I saw retreat centers in Israel are like retreat centers everywhere, anywhere I've ever been in the world, in that they become a magnet for all the local dogs. And I came out of the office one day and I saw this dog lying on the ground outside of the office door. And I looked at it, and first I just kind of briefly glanced at it, and then I looked again and I saw this dog had this huge mass growing out of its head. And it was lying there on the ground. And it was one of those moments when you see something so shocking that, you know, your mind doesn't even really work for a moment. You just kind of feel stunned. And then, of course, the thoughts kick in. And you know, one of my first thoughts was, well, who's taking care of this dog? You know, it's been neglected. Who's taking care of this dog? And then letting that one go, I decided, well, the best I could do would be to send loving kindness to this dog. This dog clearly was in terrible shape. So I spent the morning, you know, practicing loving kindness for this dog. You know, may it be well, may it be peaceful, may it be healed. I went back to the office later on in the day, came back out, and there was the dog sitting up without the mass. The mass was on the ground beside it. I was not deluded enough to think, oh, my loving kindness was really effective. But what I did see was, of course, this mass that I'd seen growing out of the dog's head was just one of the stones in the desert. It was exactly the same color as the dog's fur, you know. And this was a whole reality I'd built up, you know, throughout the day, gone through my day, totally believing in this construct. I kind of missed the point. We see when we take hold of a fragment and seize it so quickly that our judgments form, our realities form around it. Of course we do miss the wholeness. It becomes very frozen. Life becomes very frozen. People can become very frozen for us. We can even become very frozen in our own eyes and judgments. And the thing is that when we have hooked into a particular detail or description, seized upon it, it's almost impossible in that seizing to see anything else. Some of you have been on, of course, residential retreats, and you've had the experience, you know, of sitting beside the person with the endless shuffle. You know, and they sit there, you know, you sit there and, you know, shift, shift, shuffle, shuffle, you know, squeak, squeak, rustle, rustle. And after a while, people tell me that they don't even notice when the person stops shuffling. Even the moments when you know, it's not happening, they're just waiting for it to happen. You're just waiting for it to happen. It's like if you have somebody in your life who's really offended you. You know, if they are, you know, you're just waiting for the next thing to happen. Even when it's not happening, there's no, you know, we've kind of surrendered the spaciousness, the openness of just appreciating the wholeness in that moment. We sense how contracted we can become through that seizing upon the fragments. It's like breathing in and never breathing out. It's like looking only at the clouds in the sky and never seeing the space. And of course, we're most prone to do that when we're not so present. We're most prone to be judgmental, to take things for granted, to form assumptions. When we really don't feel so present, that's when we're most prone to sink into those contracted spaces. But it's kind of like abandoning. It's like abandoning ourselves. Or if we hold only a judgment of another person, it's like we have abandoned them. It's a little bit like the doctor with Rebecca. If only his neurological assessment had been honored, Rebecca would have been abandoned and confined to a life much less than what was possible for her. When this human assessment was honored, then Rebecca too was honored as a whole person and encouraged to reach for what was possible. In meditation practice, we learn essentially to be present and to be attentive rather than inattentive. We learn to question rather than to be assume, rather than to assume. We learn to be awake rather than to be lost in the habits of our own constructs and images. And essentially, we are learning the art of non-abandonment. We're learning the art of how to embrace the whole of another person, the completeness of the moment, the completeness of ourselves, rather than seizing upon the fragments. I think this art of non-abandonment lies not only in investigation, but it lies too in our dedication to reach for healing, to reach for freedom, to reach for the completeness that is possible, rather than settling for contractedness and fragmentation. I think we can learn to pay attention to those slogans and mantras that come up in our minds that say, I am, you are, this is. We also learn to pay attention to what it is that we dwell upon and obsess about, what it is that repeats itself in our minds, the judgments, the images. Because I think all of that, learning to pay attention to all of that, then the very places where we're most contracted also become the doorways of opening, of understanding what is true. You know, there's a whole Zen practice and Zen tradition that really rests in asking just this one question, what is this? What is this? You know, no matter what arises, to really hold it in the light of that question. What is this? And it is really a practice of seeking to understand what is true, rather than just assuming that we know or assuming our judgments are the absolute truth in every moment. We see that dwelling or judgment, it doesn't really last that long or take that tight of hold in the light of investigation. Many of our beliefs, many of our judgments, many of our assumptions are actually quite latent and habitual. We don't even know we have them until we find somehow our beliefs or our judgments or constructs clashing with somebody else's. I have a teenage son, and sometimes, you know, his friends kind of float through our house, and I mean, usually ignoring me completely, but once in a while they get stuck in a room with me inadvertently, which I'm sure is deeply disturbing for them, and they actually feel forced to talk to me, and you know, and I remember one time this young man, he was obviously being well brought up, you know, very polite, and he asked me what I did. So I tried to explain to him a little bit what I did, and he said, why would anybody do that? So I started giving him a little Dharma talk, you know, about how everybody wants to be peaceful and everybody, you know, wants serenity. And he looked at me and he said, I don't. And I realized I felt really quite offended, you know. It's like, how do you mean you don't want to be peaceful, you know? And I realized, well, that's a construct. You know, for him that's not true in that moment. Well, why should I hold that construct that everybody wants to be peaceful? Why should I be trying to convince this young man that he wants to be peaceful? You know, or that he wants to be free and he wants to be sweet. He doesn't. He wants to be active. He wants excitement. He wants drama. That's okay. But I could see that little moment of offense and how it was kind of just this little moment of separation and contraction. It's so interesting how often our beliefs truly just kind of lying there sleeping, you know, waiting for someone to come along in the world who actually sees life a little differently than we do. And those are really crucial moments, because we can see in the face of that our temptation is either to feel it offended or to withdraw or to become very judgmental or self-righteous or, you know, explaining ourselves or convincing another. It's also a little moment when we can learn to listen. where we can learn to be still, to open our hearts to receive, to kind of feel a confidence in that stillness and a confidence in that opening, which is never, it's interesting that opening is never a cause of division and separation. But holding and clinging in our world truly is a cause of separation and division. Sometimes we see the way in which our beliefs and our constructs and our assumptions are kind of anxiety driven, compelled by fear, the fear of uncertainty, of not knowing, of not having a position, almost the fear sometimes that if we don't have a position within ourselves, somehow we're going to be submerged within everybody else's assumptions or positions. At times we find ourselves almost wanting to make our world secure and familiar, to make our relationships secure and familiar by judgment, by opinion, by being able to say, I am and you are. It's almost as if to say, I don't know, sets us into this abyss of vulnerability and feeling adrift. But more and more, I think we do come to see in our lives that opinions and judgments and images born of anxiety, they just don't lead to peace, they don't lead to intimacy. They make us more anxious and insecure. The other part, I think, that is sometimes important to be aware of is the kind of protection that we feel that our beliefs and conclusions and judgments offer to us. You know, if I really believe someone to be an irritating, annoying, obnoxious person, and I really invest in that image and that assumption and belief, then I feel pretty secure in feeling irritated. You know, I feel actually pretty justified in feeling annoyed and feeling judgmental. If I really assume that to be the truth, then actually I might not feel very much inspiration to cultivate a greater generosity or tolerance or patience within my own heart. So sometimes our beliefs protect us from changes we feel unable or unwilling or impossible to make. Investigation, the whole purpose of investigation is to awaken us, to inspire openness and vastness. And there are, I would say, two elements or two dimensions of investigation. One of them is reflective, and the other is experiential. Reflective investigation, I think, can permeate all of our lives. It can permeate our meditation. To take a moment to pause at the end of our meditations and just to reflect. Where was our attention dwelling? What was sticking in our minds? What qualities of heart or quality of consciousness was present? Were we contracted? Were we spacious? Were we balanced? Were we agitated? Sometimes the moments of reflection, they're not judgment in disguise. Moments of reflection sometimes reveal to us maybe where we might need to let go a little more in this life, what we might need to cultivate. Reflective investigation can be brought to some person we obsess about or something that preoccupies us to bring a quality of questioning, to probe what is needed. You know, in those moments of alienation, of reaction, of anger, of division, what is it that is really needed to be cultivated in those moments that might bring healing, that might bring understanding, that might bring peace? Sometimes we bring reflection to the places where we find ourselves holding most tenaciously in our life, And we simply ask ourselves, what is it that I'm being asked to let go of? Sometimes just the question of what is this? What is this? To bring it to all the moments of stickiness, of alienation, of estrangement in our lives can be deeply revealing. Reflective investigation is sometimes also just within the field of the Dhamma. Do we understand suffering and the causes of suffering? Do we understand healing and the causes of healing? Do we understand the nature of change and impermanence and its implication in our own lives? When we see the judgment arising that says, I am, having the willingness to turn that around and say, am I? When you see the judgment of another arising that says, you are, to have the willingness to turn that around and say, are you? It is in the service. Investigation is always in the service of finding freedom in the moment. It's a divine curiosity in search of freedom and peace. It's not just thinking. It is cultivating a more intuitive probing, the divine curiosity of the moment. Investigation is also experiential. Finding the willingness to extend our psychological and emotional and spiritual horizons. Really probing all those places in our lives when we tell ourselves, I can't do this. Or this is impossible to me. In the smallest ways in meditation, you know, when you see yourself feeling, oh, it's impossible for me to be present in this moment, or impossible for me to open to this. To have the willingness just to approach it gently, that's experiential investigation. I mean, meditation practice in itself is experiential investigation because we are exploring what it means to be present rather than following the pathways of abandonment. It's exploring what it means to be awake rather than being lost in habitual fantasies or daydreams. Sometimes we explore what it means to stay intimate and close with something that is challenging or difficult, when we know that our habit or our inclination may just be to flee. It is not about proving something. It's about seeing what happens, what may unfold, to explore what may be possible for us. It's really about stepping into what we don't know. In meditation, it's often suggested that the most direct way to transformation is really to turn towards everything that we're tempted to flee from, to stay connected with everything we're tempted to abandon, to commit ourselves to wakefulness, and to investigate what is possible. Investigation is essentially a path of being free. If we have just a moment quietly together.